And, of course, we've got Linda Moulton-Howe with us. She's going to update a number of stories, but we're going to take your phone calls as well. Conversations with Linda now for 2 hours on Coast to Coast AM. Let's go back over some stories, Linda. We'll take calls as well. Any updates on those structures off the coast of Cuba?
Well, I last talked with Paulina Zelitsky when she was in Havana. She was the Russian oceanographer who had discovered these back in, it was May of 2001. And at Earth Files, I've done about a dozen reports on this with her and with the geologist, Dr. Iturralde. And the last time that I did an interview with him and with her was back in September of 2003. They were both in Havana at the time, and Dr. Manuel Iturralde is a geologist at the National Museum of Natural History in Havana, and he had become very interested in the fact that the side scan sonar that Paulina Zelitsky was able to get showed a lot of 90-degree angles, and that is not something that you just see every day in the a half mile down in the ocean.
That's
and
this true.
A half mile down off the western tip of Cuba. Well, another thing that really impressed Dr. Iturralde is that the sonar images, in terms of measurements now, and I'll give them in feet, the sonar images on these rectangular structures were 492 to 656 feet in length and about 164 to 328 feet in width. That's huge. And what Paulina had proposed to National Geographic and was still under discussion up till 2003 was that they would get a robot made that could go down and drill right into one of these megalithic structures and see what it's made out of. And this is part of the fascinating mystery. Dr. Iturralde, in looking at the videotape that was taken by Paulina Zelitsky's equipment underwater, thought or thinks that it looks like granite. Well, here's the problem. There is no granite on Cuba. Cuba is limestone, similar to the Yucatan.
Right.
If they went down to these structures, which do look so perfectly 90-degree rectangular, and they got granite, well, it would be like, I think, finally a headline on the New York Times that something a half mile down off the western tip of Cuba, this size with 90-degree angles was made of granite. Where would it have come from? How could it have been moved there? There's no indigenous granite. All of those were these wonderful questions that Paulina Zelitsky thought that National Geographic would take on. Last year, I called National Geographic because Paulina had given up for lack of money to do any of this on her own.
Oh, what a shame, huh?
Yeah, that was the big problem. And she went to do more oceanographic work off of Mexico. And out of interest, I followed up with the National Geographic people that I had talked to off and on over the last 5 years about this whole megalithic possibility. And they said that they had decided, National Geographic had decided not to pursue the story at this time. It wasn't a closed issue. So today, as we are ending 2006, it still remains one of those huge mysteries, a half mile down in extremely cold, extremely rapidly moving water off the western tip of Cuba, and these tantalizing sonar and radar that are absolutely amazing. And she sent me a videotape that she had in which the video camera is moving underwater with a light. And I'm looking at them right now in my September 2003 Earth Files, in which you've got truly rounded. It looks absolutely formed, granite-like rock. It looks as if like something that you would find that had been made for some sort of a building. And there was a squared-off large block of granite amid these megalithic structures. And there is one where it shows, it looks almost like a totally perfect 90-degree corner on one of these megalithic structures underwater. And in one of them, there is what appears to be, and I'm looking at a video frame, and it seems to be a kind of V-shaped pattern. It is not like something that is totally interpretive.
Right.
It does seem to be a V-shaped pattern that loops at the bottom. And the questions that were raised by Paulina Zelitsky and to National Geographic and others, is this a carved symbol? If it is, and if there are other of these symbols on these megalithic structures, then this is like a huge, gigantic find. If these turned out through coring with a robot to be natural mineral or marine life deposit that just happened to look like a kind of symbol that has been found in Etruscan and other ancient cultures, that would be really a fluke. And so the answer is, from 2003 to 2006, nothing more has been done. And the mysteries are as profound now as they were then.
Do these structures, Linda, look like they're intact or like they could have been dumped in there?
Oh, no, they're so huge. It is. I know what you're asking. How could anything this large end up on the bottom of a half mile down?
Yes.
If they had fallen, it doesn't make sense, right? And this is something I talked with Paulina Zelitsky about long ago. And she and Dr. Iteraldi, the geologist in Havana, what they suggested is a possibility without knowing. If these are structures, it is a possibility that on that, if you look at the map, for example, I have at Earth Files that shows exactly the area off the western tip where these megalithic structures are, it's not very far to the tip of the Yucatan. And there has been all kinds of speculation about there once being a land bridge there. And if there had been a land bridge and there had been some gigantic seismic event, then maybe an entire section of land containing these gigantic 90-degree cornered structures might have literally sunk down, a subsidence. This has happened. Maybe not this deep, but there have been examples in the planet where there's been known seismic events and some structures have sunk like an elevator. The thing about this is it's just so deep. And I think that's been one of the big questions. And as the National Geographic person said to me, to operate that deep and that water is that fast and that cold, and knowing that they would have to get this drilling operation to work, that sort of arguing almost against the project was, how could anything structured this large be down that deep? Well, that's part of the mystery. What if they are structures?
Well, we got to get the guy who went down and looked at the Titanic. I wonder if he'd go down there.
I think that there were discussions with him about this. And why exactly there has been so much interference and the inability for Paulina Zelitsky to get financing in place that would make a robot and be able to go down there or get cooperation by somebody, I think it was Ballard.
Robert Ballard.
Yes. That I'm not sure, because none of us know exactly what all of the considerations are by Ballard in the work that he's doing now and what Paulina Zelitsky, and here's another big consideration. 5 years ago, when this was first discovered, Fidel Castro was a healthy man. And Paulina told me that they had been given strict instructions as she and her husband operating out of Havana, that whatever was to be discovered in this megalithic site, as they refer to it, was Cuban. It was to be for the Cuban government, for the Cuban natural science. They did not want any other scientists coming in to work there, and that, again, might be one of the problems.
Let's go to some of the phones, and we'll come back and talk a little bit about that jet fighter plane that's down there on the bottom of Lake Superior next to what could be a UFO. We'll go to our chat room line, find out where they're calling from. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
This is Godrock from the NighthawkZone.com.
Nighthawk Zone. Hi there. How are you, Godrock?
We're doing just fine. Linda.
Yeah.
We know you had an interview on Dreamland a couple months ago with alien abductee Jim Sparks.
Oh, yes.
And we wanted to hear your thoughts, your impressions on Jim Sparks.
Sure.
And Jim, I'll listen off the air.
All right, Godrock. Thanks. Jim Sparks was just on with Art as well. Linda, go ahead.
Well, my conversations with Jim go back to the early 1990s. And in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness, that came out in 1998, which is almost 10 years ago, Jim gave me permission to use a good portion of his story and drawings in Chapter 3 of Glimpses, Volume 2, because he did not know if he would ever actually publish his own book. And in this decade of knowing Jim, I can say that of all of the people in the abduction syndrome that I have ever interviewed, spent time with, worked on a project, that he is one of the most down-to-earth people that I have ever, ever met. And it is his down-to-earthness that is part of the strength of his story. Because when you are with Jim Sparks, you're with a guy who always calls a spade a spade. There's nothing about him that exaggerates, and I still can remember the very first time sitting, talking with him at a conference in which he was trying to explain that he had had this very, very normal life up until his 30s, and he was married, and he was in real estate, and doing all of that kind of normal kind of stuff, and suddenly, as he says, something from someplace else, not here, entered his life and turned it upside down, and that most of it, this is what is remarkable about the Jim Sparks, I guess you call it the abduction syndrome,
mm-hmm.
is that it was largely conscious, that he would be totally aware of this sound coming into the room, feeling his heart beginning to beat. He didn't think that his heart beating was necessarily because he was afraid, but because of whatever the energy was that was taking him up, and you have to assume that if he is lifted from his bed, he's going through a ceiling and a roof that other people have tried to describe, and that's where you'll hear arguments, well, it couldn't possibly be the real human body. It must be some out-of-body form. Well, as far as Jim was concerned, he went as a person. He went as a body, and that he would end up in craft with his mind intact, but he always wanted to fight. He wanted to fight, in this case, the gray entities that were trying to make him sit in front of what he said looked like computer consoles and learn a non-human alphabet numbering system. They showed him holographic projections in the air that would contain information, would contain whole scenes, sort of like George Lucas used in Star Wars,
yes.
That he knew that he was in the presence of technology, and that when he was in the presence of the technology, he said, Linda, you could take 20 pages, and this is demonstrated very well in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, and Jim has a new book out, which I recommend to all Coast listeners. It's called The Keepers, and this has just come out in the last couple of months. Jim finally did his book, and he says, this is technology, and when I was in their presence, they would show me that they could take 20 pages of what we would call, let's say, for us, English, and those 20 pages could end up in a tiny black dot. And the black dot would be, have every all the content, and that you had to be in the technology, and you could look at that black dot, and somehow the whole thing would be in your head. But he said he'd come back to his house and where he had a normal life, and the idea that he could look at a dot and get all of that translation back out, he never thought that was possible. He had to be in the presence of their technology. And what is very interesting about the Jim Sparks story, in addition to the huge detail in which they try to instruct him, his resistance, they're paralyzing him until he would cooperate, then allowing him freedom as his biggest treat is freedom, freedom to move if he would do what they were trying to train him to do. Ultimately, this is a story that I just posted today at Earth Files because I thought it was so important in the wake of his new book out to let people know that it isn't. It was not just the so-called gray Ebens. Jim had an encounter with what he called reptilian beings, and they gave a warning, and they gave their agenda, and I always thought it was one of the most powerful pieces of his story. And the way Jim described it, he said, Linda, I mean, honest to God, I was in the air. I was conscious. It's me. It's my body. And I'm coming down from someplace into what was kind of a carnival park. And he remembered absolutely floating over a large old-fashioned wooden roller coaster. And I have a drawing at Earth Files that shows a dozen large reptilian non-humans in a circle waiting for him to come down in front of them. And when he does, this is one of the, it's kind of charming, actually. They had scales. They had eyes that we would associate with something like vertical pupils, let's say, mm-hmm. in an alligator. They were very tall, much taller than Jim, very big. And he said, you know, they would be, I mean, when I first talked to him about this, he said, quote unquote, they would be scary as hell. But the one of them that was closest to Jim did this, like, just suddenly out of nowhere, is a human face glowing, projected right over the front of this reptilian, scaly-looking face. And Jim said as soon as he had that human holographic face to look at, he calmed down. He felt perfectly fine. And what was so interesting is that whatever these beings are, which have come up in other abduction syndrome stories, in Jim's case, he thinks that everything happened absolutely consciously in that carnival, and that they talk about trying to communicate with our government about, and this was a quote, your planet is in grave trouble. And they talk about the environment. They warn about what is happening to your air, your water. It's contaminated. Your forests, jungles, trees, and plant life are dying. There are several breaks in your food chain. You have an overwhelming amount of nuclear and biological weapons, which include nuclear and biological contamination. Your planet is overpopulated. Warning, it is almost to the point of being too late.
Almost like the movie Lost in Space with the robot going, warning, Will Robinson, warning, how true. We'll be back in a moment. More calls with Linda Moulton Howe. Well, there's not too much longer where the CDs will be gone again. The double CDs, the old Father Malachi Martin interviews that Art did, Perfect Possession, Exorcisms, Demons. Take advantage of it. Get the CDs for free. You just pay shipping and handling. When you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter, call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Conversations with Linda. We'll do it again next hour as well. Let's go to the phones. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
This is Bruce.
Hey, Bruce. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. I heard in this very show that there is no snow on Mount Kilimanjaro. And what I would like to know, since Mount Kilimanjaro is the highest point in Africa, is there any snow in Africa?
Well, you're asking a good question in the light of even more depressing data having to do with what's happening with the lakes. I can tell you that just based on a conversation with Lonnie Thompson from Ohio State University just about 4 or 5 months ago after he had gotten back from a trip to Mount Kilimanjaro, he said that the rate of the melt of that glacier that has been there for centuries is now so rapid that he's afraid that there really will not be any of the glacier left in the year 2009. And we're moving into 2007 in just a couple of weeks or so. And that was actually surprising to him because for a while there were debates about whether some of the glaciers like Mount Kilimanjaro might get more snow and ice and keep building back up. And the very distressing news is that has not been happening, as the caller is suggesting. And what is at stake here is that there are hundreds of thousands of people who have relied upon the glacier water source for their life
forever
in that area,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
And right now, this is another one of those sentences that you're going to hear more discussion about. And it seems so impossible to contemplate. But with the melting of Mount Kilimanjaro's glaciers so quickly, and these facts right now, Africa's greatest lake, Victoria, in Uganda, it has covered 27,000 square miles. That's about the size of Ireland. And it is the biggest freshwater body in the world after Lake Superior in the United States. And it is the source of the Nile River, which provides water for 100 million Egyptians, Sudanese and others, let alone the people around Lake Victoria in Africa. And it has, in the last 3 years, it has this huge 27,000 square miles has dropped down 6 feet. Think about this.
Yeah.
That is a that is like
huge.
Ireland dropping down 6 feet. Well, along with Lake Victoria dropping, and the drought there is serious, with Mount Kilimanjaro, it may be completely gone, the glacier, in 2 years or so. And Lake Chad. Lake Chad was once the world's sixth largest lake, and it has now shrunk to only about 2% of the size that it was in 1960, 2%. Well, you can see when you start adding up what is happening with water in Africa, that entire populations are going to be faced with having to move. But where are they going to move?
Back to some more calls. We'll go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Good. Thank you. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from South Carolina, a long-time listener.
Thank you. Go ahead.
George, I've enjoyed your shows, and you're truly a gentleman and a scholar. Linda, I've enjoyed your reports from around the world, and I can only imagine that you must live out of a suitcase all your life.
Sometimes. It's true.
It can only be that. I have a question on the bird kill. I had heard a report later this evening that it's a possibility that they got some tainted grain, some moldy grain that might have done the mass killing.
Yes, I talked about that a little bit in the first hour, and that is, as of this afternoon, David Parrish with the Jerome, Idaho Fish and Game Department said that they did not have all of the lab reports in. And he sent me an email and said they were going to hold a press conference tomorrow morning, Friday, December 15th. And then after 8:30 CNN came on with a statement by a USGS wildlife specialist. It's a speculation from reading it. And he's saying this probably is the fungus that can cause mold on grain. And he's relating it back to a mallard duck kill in Ohio last year in 2005 that killed 500. This 2,500, and that's a count by the Idaho Fish and Game Department, 2,500, that is without precedent in U.S. history. And as I understood from David Parrish, they had a lot of laboratories looking at a lot of different specimens because they want to make sure that whatever they announce, that it's correct. Because if this was some virus or bacteria that could cause this kind of impact on the ducks, they've got to know. If it is the fungus, what is the source? And he told me today that they had been sending people out all over that area of Oakley, Idaho, looking for any kind of moldy contaminated grain. And as of this afternoon, up to 4 o'clock, they had not found any.
What's the latest on that plane on the bottom of Lake Superior with some kind of object or something next to it?
Right. Well, I'll tell you, how to put this.
Oh, really?
I know that the investigators are well. I think there will be more development, that all of the efforts to try to push this into a hoax category for whatever reasons, I don't think were well-founded, and that it may not happen for a while, but hopefully if all goes well, there may be more news in the summer of 2007.
Sounds like you're working on something, Linda. Speaking of working on something, you know, I did two pilots for the Sci-Fi Cable Network.
Right.
And I dropped your name. So if the show gets picked up, I'd like to use you as our roaming reporter.
Well, that would be terrific.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yes, I love to explore Earth mysteries.
Yes, you do. And it'll get you back into dabbling in television a little bit.
Right.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Well, it's great show, Linda. Always a nice list to hear you on the radio.
Thank you.
And I was wondering, I was looking on the maps on the planet Earth. I was looking at, I don't know if you noticed this, but the South Pole, North Pole, they're completely different. South Pole is a huge mass of ice and snow, and North Pole, there's almost nothing there. So it's
on the moon.
No, on the Earth. I was looking on the Earth. Yeah, I mean, it's just it used to be like it was pretty much equal portion.
I was going to say, if you were talking about the moon, there wasn't snow to my knowledge.
Not yet. Well, maybe sometime soon. But I was just noticing. I don't know. I'm starting to think that as we get towards 2012. I mean, it's sort of ironic that we're noticing this. Every year is getting worse and worse, and it's not only our polar caps or mountain, but the other planets are having the same effect too. So most people, you know, who are saying that it's our cars that are creating this, maybe it's actually adjusting our planet's temperature a little bit, but you know, you can't say much for the other planets that are having the same problem as well.
The problem is data. The only data that was suggested is that there appears to be some melt on Mars. We're not talking about all throughout the solar system. There is no data. But when it comes to why poles on any planet might be in a melt mode or a refreeze mode, it is erratic on the Earth. It would be erratic on Mars, and it could relate to a lot of factors, taking the sun out of the equation, because the solar astrophysicists say that there is no data indicating that the sun's energy is appreciably changing. So what's happening on Mars and what's happening on the Earth may not have any direct link whatsoever. Just keep that as part of the data set here. And when it comes to the Earth and what is happening at the Arctic and the Antarctic, the computer modeling, there are 9 different laboratories on our planet that have been trying to project with computer modeling. As more and more data come in all the time, they keep updating these computer modelings. And there always was a projection that there would be more warming in the Arctic. And that has absolutely been happening at such a rate that it is stunning. And there have been a whole series of reports in 2006 about the rapid melt even of Greenland, which they had not thought would be at the stage that it is now in melt now, maybe for another 25 years, and it's already occurring. When it comes to Antarctica at the south, there was always a, depending upon what's happening with the ocean warming and the various currents and all of the complex patterns of the oceans, the computer models always saw that it could be a up and down melt and ice and melt and ice in Antarctica. And the one thing that is very clear is that there have been increasing numbers of large icebergs melting and breaking off of the Ross Ice Shelf and other areas in Antarctica. So even if there are some parts that have a buildup in snow, the general trend in Antarctica is to these calving icebergs that are coming out into the seas. And in general, we are in a melt status at both poles.
Okay, thanks for the response, Linda. Let's move next to our next wildcard line. You're on Coast to Coast. It is your turn. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Take it away.
All right. Linda, George, nice to talk to y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a very detailed question, and I want to get it through as best I can because it's an important question to me. In the United States and all around the world, we have financial competition between all countries, okay? And in the deliverance of this capitalistic financial responsibility that each country has, it's caused wars, it's caused death. I mean, the human nature, the human competitive nature causes wars. Now, if we're going to the moon and we're going to Mars to extend the human race, to extend human life, why would we take that financial competition? Why would we take that financial barrier that divides us as a world to other places if it's intended to extend the human race?
Well, remember, if you heard the first half hour, and I had the interview with John Logsdon. He is a longtime director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University in Bethesda, and he's on all kinds of panels and groups dealing with NASA. And he said, when I asked him about the NASA's interest in the practical applications of both resources and having an escape route, they're talking about escape routes from the moon and Mars, or from Earth to the moon and Mars. And he said, the president's science advisor, John Marburger, said in a speech last spring, meaning spring of 2006, that this is not really about science. It's about extending the sphere of economic activity into the solar system. So the practical answer, I think, to your question is that right now the priorities of the United States is to join with other countries that could help pay for getting a permanent moon base on the moon, for whatever economic advantages there will be for the Earth, and then using that as a launching point to Mars. And that's why the cooperation, and that's why the need for sharing the cost.
Next up, west of the Rockies, it's your turn with Linda Moulton Howe. Hi there.
Hi there.
Go ahead, sir.
You hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering about the sun, and like that of a light bulb, right before it burns out, is that possibly what our sun could be experiencing? And 2012 is just merely the day that it snuffs out.
No, I really don't think so.
Let's at least hope not.
Yes, our sun is of a kind of garden variety yellow sun in this arm of the galaxy, and it has an expected life of 10 billion years before it would supernova or turn into a red giant, whichever way it's going to go. And we are now in that that what would be the 4+ billion years. So we're getting to the, it's a middle age solar system and a middle age sun. And the 11-year cycles, maximum and minimum, over 22 years or thereabouts, that's been going on for as long as there's been observations of the sun and sunspots. So we're not coming up against any kind of as far as I would know, or any astrophysicist, of any kind of crisis in our sun, outside of the fact that it might be a very intense, active solar maximum, and that's occurred on this planet before. And what is not known is if there are a series of X flares that are very strong on a planet that is now so dependent upon so many satellites in orbit, could it end up interfering with the infrastructure of shipments, airplanes, all of that? It's really more of an impact on what we would call a modern electronic world that is dependent upon satellites as we move toward 2012. Now, I know that there have been speculations about whether or not there could be something like a galactic pulse from the center of our galaxy, none of which has been experienced by current human civilization. And it's all speculation that we are at a time when the Earth itself is undergoing gigantic change and tremendous amounts of surface life extinction of animals and plants because of global warming. Will there be upsides coming out of global warming? Possibly. But the thing about it is, we're on a path now. The Earth is changing, and it's changing rapidly. And that is right now as much a concern as anything that might be happening astronomically.
Linda, did you ever investigate the bizarre story of that alleged time traveler, John Teeter?
Not him specifically, but the strangest thing, I saw an ad. Somebody sent me some kind of a little newsletter, and it said, "I am a time traveler, and I am looking for fellow time travelers." And it gave an email address. And I thought, well, wonder what would I get a reply? So I sent an inquiry to this alleged time traveler, looking for a time traveler, and said, I'm very interested in discussing your perception of time travel. It took 4.5 months, literally. I'd forgotten. And I got back an email a couple of months ago that said, your planet is coming up against a lot of problems, and the suggestion was the time travelers were trying to help us. And I'm serious. That was an exchange.
Stay with us. Another hour to go. Conversations with Linda. We'll talk about crop formations. Yes, these animal mutilation stories. Whatever happened to Dan Burrish? He's the one who said he saw an extraterrestrial. We'll be back in a moment.